In this episode, we sit down with Dave, an international angler, a renowned saltwater journalist, and a long-term Shimano water consultant. Hit the like button, leave a comment, and remember to subscribe to the podcast. Let's dive in.
Welcome to another episode of the Tuna Gear podcast. I'm Andy. We've got Danny back in the hot seat next to me again. No jokes about you. Today, we've got Dave Lewis. Thank you for coming to England, mate. Thank you for taking the travel down.
My visa came through on time, so I managed to make it across the bridge. And
I did notice the UK bumper sticker on the car they probably made you as you just came across. Mm-hmm. Mate, thank you for coming down.
Thanks for the invite.
No. This is one that I've been...
I must say, but when I was invited to come down, I was promised a speckled hen or two. And
I'm disappointed for Danny and Walter. What happened, mate? What happened? How have you got this so wrong?
It was the 14 beers you gave me last night and me not getting into early hours in the morning.
Next time, I'll make sure the speckled hen is down here. I did offer to go and get
them. But there we go. I'll let it go.
Aaron, you're going to have to leg it to Sainsbury's and go and get speckled hen for
I'll make up for it later.
We will definitely make up for it later. Don't worry. We will definitely make out.
Cheers.
Make up for it later. You've pretty much done everything, mate. There isn't too much.
I've done
much.
Everything. I've been very fortunate. I've done a fair amount, but
I was doing a bit of digging around this morning to try and bring myself up to speed with some of this stuff because there is so much.
Okay.
And when you've got experienced sea angler and fishing all rounder Dave Lewis has accepted invitations to become an angling trust ambassador and has called for more anglers to become members, it goes on Sea Angling Magazine.
31 years.
So this is old then, because it's only got 30 years on here. Saltwater ambassador for Shimano UK, pro staffer for AFCO. And I think the list just goes on from there. And then all the fishing that you do in between that. How do you fit all that in? That sounds like full-time on top of full-time.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be full-time on top of full-time, but it used to be a full-time firefighter. I retired in 2012. I did 30 years, at my full 30 years. I joined at 21, and it was a 30-year contract, basically, and I retired at 51. And then it was tight.
Did you miss it when you retired?
Yeah,
you miss
the camaraderie with most of the people you work with. You know, the actual work side of the job it's a lifestyle thing more than
one of my mates is a firefighter,
a manufacturing job, but the job's changed out of all recognition to what I joined.
It's quite a political thing nowadays.
It's a totally political thing, and I think the job that I joined was better environment to work in, and I think it was a better service for the public. And let's leave that at that, it's not what it used to be.
But from retiring, you got to put all your efforts or all your time then into scratching that itch that you've got for fishing.
But I was doing a lot around the fire service, because the way the shift pattern works, you work 4 days, 2 days, two nights, four off, 2 days, two nights, four off. I stayed operational for the entire 30 years, primarily or only because it allowed me to do what I do. So the way it works, if I took 4 days leave, that gave me a 12-day break. And then, you can do a lot of fishing and travel a lot in that 12 days. Or I could do that 5-6 times of the year and, spend a lot of time with the family as well. But the key thing is Alison, my wife of 37 years now, she has been 100% supportive from day one. And
that's quite a rarity, because you hear a lot of guys talking about fishing widows, don't you?
It's just getting the balance right. And no other job in the world would have allowed me to do anything like I did when I was working and maintain, a happy marriage, a steady marriage. Because it was built towards 2012 when I retired, and then it just sort of meshed seamlessly into what I do now.
So you're fishing as within fishing. I mean, I've seen on TV the magazines from years back, way before we're talking of retirements and the fire brigade. Mm-hmm. So fishing as you being a character within the fishing industry working, and I've seen the TV stuff you've done, and obviously you've spoke about the magazine stuff. How did that come about? How did you all of a sudden start working within fishing?
How'd you go from the average Joe angler into being...
Simple answer. I needed the money to go fishing. I needed the... When we got married, I was a firefighter. My wife was in social services. We had a young family, and money was tight. I mean, it was seriously tight. And it started... You know, obviously, I wanted to go fishing, but, you know, I couldn't go off, say, I'm going to do this, that, and the other. And, you know, we're struggling to run the house and, you know, buy nappies and, you know, pay bills. I mean, money was tough for a long time. So it started off with a bit of bait digging. I mean, that's, you know, I used to, you know, dig my own bait and then, you know, supply some of the shops. And then right back in the very, I don't know if you're aware, the Drew family from Tynmouth. They
Team Bates.
Team Bates. Well, I'm going back to the mid 1980s now. Okay. Nigel Drew. I was very friendly with him, and we used to bring up crab. So it started off as a bit of a bait business, bringing some funding in.
So it's a tie into Devon. You didn't know that was going to happen, did you?
Yeah. Tynmouth is as the crow flies. Yeah.
It's funny. I drove over the team on the way down, and it brought back a lot of memories. I mean, I was back and forth.
Sandhill hotspot, Bass hotspot.
Sandhills, very much back in those on the back beach there. But yeah, that's it. Sheldon. I spent a lot of time there. But going back to the magazines, we got married in 87, and around the same time I came very involved with bass and bass conservation. I was a member of the Bass Angler Sports Fishing Society. I ended up as vice chairman, but I was a member for a long time. And I got to know a lot of people, like Mike Ladle, Dave Coolin, who used to do a regular column for the Angler's Mail, John Dowling, you know, a lot of these people. And just to backstep a little bit, this time of the year, May, in certain Welsh rivers, we had and still get a strong run of shad. Tweight shad. I've never seen an Isle of Shad, it's nearly all tweight shad. And we used to fish them because it was totally legal back then. It's not now. I won't say where we used to fish, but you know the fish are still there. And I used to be able to catch these things to order. And a lot of people in the Bass Anglers Sports Fishing Society, we got chatting. It was, I'd love to catch a shad. Like, I can guarantee you a shad. And, you know, we went back and forth. And then it was a case of, why didn't you write an article about this? I said, who's going to publish this? And I had an E for my English O-level. I can't write an article. They said, do it. So I did. And I sent it off to a magazine the other day. This was about 1989 now.
Handwritten?
The first one was handwritten, and I got my mother... The first couple were handwritten, and I got my mother to type them out. She had a typewriter.
I was going to say typewriter, yeah.
Again, going back to my supportive wife, Alison, I came home from work the one day, and there's a typewriter. This is like a couple of months down the line. But anyway, back to the shad, I wrote this article and sent it off to a magazine called Sea Fishing. And that was it. I forgot about it for a couple of months. And then I was buying the magazines, as we did back then. Hopefully still do today. People buy magazines. But opened it the one day and, gee, it's my article. And then...
What was that feeling like?
It was wow. You know, it was just... I was really impressed. But the best feeling was a couple of weeks later when a check came through the letterbox, 35 quid. And that was it, you know, that was, I said, now listen, 35 quid, you know, we'll have a takeaway tonight, we'll have a couple of bottles of wine, and, you know, and this was this. So
it's like 100 quid in new money, isn't it, back then?
It was a decent sum. I mean, this is, you know, late 1980s, it was worth having. And the editor's name, was it Guy Milham? I'm pretty certain it was Guy Milham. I phoned him up and, you know, I said, oh, thanks, you know, do you want, you know, any interest in anything else? What else do you do? I said, well, I do this, that, the other. He said, yeah, send us a couple of articles on this. And it became regular. I started contributing on a regular basis. this was way before the days of spell checkers, so I honestly sorry to anyone who had to, you know, work on my copy in those days, because it would have been bordering on the impossible. But they did, and I got more and more into it, and as a result of that, I got more and more into the photography, because even back then, the photography was becoming more and more of a thing. Most of the magazines in the 80s, they'd have like a colour, obviously, cover, and they'd be a centre spread would be colour, and occasionally they'd have another feature. Most of it was black and white, but, you know, the colour stuff was only just really starting to come in. And I had a little Instamatic thing that I, you know, took pictures with, and it was okay. But, you know, chatting again with the editor, you know, if you can get your pictures better, you know, we can do more. And obviously the more pictures they use, you get a front cover, you get more money, which was the whole objective, is why I was doing it. Came home from work again a couple of months later, and Alison had bought me a Nikon 401, you know, the complete set. And, it just sort of built from that. And then another magazine came out called Boat Fisherman, and then another one, Shore Fishing. And they were probably six or eight magazines that had a bit of sea fishing content. You know, three or four that were solid sea fishing, and another three or four, like the Complete Angler's Guide and obviously Angler's Mail, Angler's Time. You know, they all had a bit of sea fishing content. And, you know, the more it just happened.
Did you approach those other mags?
Yes.
Did they start coming to you?
No. I sort of really, you know, this is where I was going. Like, I see this was paying decent money. It wasn't massive money.
Nice top up money.
But it was money that was funding my hobby, money left over, you know, to enhance our family life. It was working. Everything was going good. And it got to the stage when I was really, really quite, you know, busy with it. It was great. My 4 days off, I mean, like a planet around my shifts. I could, you know, a lot of my stuff then was based in South Wales, which was, again, my sort of strong point for the magazines, is that, they wanted to have, you know, copy from South Wales, because it, you know, then and now, the fishing there was excellent. I mean, this is back at the start of the really good cod days, the bass fishing. You know, there was a lot of good fishing, boat and shore. And I used to do a lot of it, and obviously provided them with the sort of material they were looking for. And then the biggest kick to the whole thing I do was at the London Boat Show in January 1993. And I met Cliff Brown, who at the time was an assistant editor on Sea Angler. Ultimately, he was the editor of Improve Your Sea Angling. And I'm not sure exactly what his role was, but he was obviously very involved with EMAP, as it was then, EMAP Publications, Sea Angler, Angling Times, Trout and Salmon, blah, 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 blah. I met him at the boat show. I don't want to start waffling.
Waffle away. But so, you know, interesting.
This is important, though. But I got chatting with Cliff, and we ended up in the press room upstairs. You know, he used to be the fireman from South Wales with a press badge on, and look at me. And he got chatting, and Alan Yates had just been appointed as a contributing editor on Sea Angler magazine, Shore Fishing. And Cliff, just out of the blue, said, would you be interested in, you know, he said, we've just taken on Alan. Would you be interested in, you know, working for Sea Angler? Because I'd done some work for Sea Angler up until then. But not really, you know, it was just news stories and bits and pieces. I said, well, yeah, of course it would. I mean, Sea Angler then was massive, you know. It's still the biggest circulation. Yeah. It's the only one that's left now. But then it was, you know, you're bordering on the days of 50,000 copies a month. It was the magazine. And, you know, if I'm honest, from day one, that was, you know, that was where I wanted to be. So there I am. I said, yeah, great. And, all right, gave my phone number. Following morning, early, you know, before 9:30, Mel Russ was on the phone. He said, hi, Dave, I mean, I understand you were, you met Cliff yesterday at London. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He said, tells me you'd be interested in working for us. I said, well, yeah, of course I could. He said, can we come down and see you? I said, well, of course you can. So the following week, Mel Russ, who I'd never met, and Ian Nichols, who at the time was the publisher of Sea Angler, came down. We had a meeting. I kind of laugh. When they made me an offer of a monthly salary, set monthly salary, to do amount of work that I knew I could do, plus all my film, all my developing, all my expenses. Alison was sat next to me in the lounge at home, and you know they offered me this, and this was a life changing experience for us. This was like a significant amount of money, and it started that March. And
did you negotiate with them? Did you hold your poker face and go, "Well, I was actually, this is a very kind offer, but I was thinking this much."
No,
snap the fucking hand off.
No, it was brilliant, and.
So what was that time frame from you doing your first one to getting that meeting in your front room where you've just...
89 to 90, 4 years. Four years. Quick. Yeah, it did. Once the touch paper was lit with that Shad article and everything came. And then, you know, people said, oh, they are Sea Angler. They don't, you know, you want to get you away from these magazines. You know, this won't work. They'll get rid of you as soon as they've, got this, you know, what they can from you. And, you know, rubbish. You know, they've been fantastic to me right the way through their evolution to where they are today, and that's 31 years now.
Things like that, it sounds more like you get back what you put in. If you're willing to contribute top quality articles, photography, why are they going to get rid of you?
Obviously, you know, I've been there a long time, and I've obviously supplied what they wanted for that, and you know. It took a lot of work. I mean, you know, Mel was, I don't think it'd be too much to say, Mel took me under his wing. We hit it off. I mean, a lot of people couldn't get on with Mel. I did. And, you know, we hit it off from day one. You know, we had a similar sense of humour. We had a similar work ethic. If he said he wanted me to do something, I'd say I'd do it, and he would have it. And I've never, ever, ever missed a deadline for any magazine in the 35, whatever it is, years I've been doing it. If I say I'll do something, I will do it. And, you know, from an editor's perspective, that is essential.
Yeah, but they can't wait. Print doesn't wait for no man, does it?
No, it was a different thing then. You know, the whole thing has changed. As, you know, with the social media thing, but back then it was like a serious thing. You had proper deadlines, and they still got deadlines, but it was different. There wasn't the material available on social media to draw stuff. You relied on your contributors, and as a contributing editor, my original contract was for 5 articles a month, 5 pieces of work, because at the time there was Sea Angler, Improve Your Sea Angling, which was Cliff's magazine. I didn't know at the time they were just about to launch Boat Angler, which is why they wanted me. Okay, just go back backtrack a little bit. I left school at 16, got the train to London, flew to Boston, joined the Merchant Navy at 16. I was 5 months away, came home for a couple of months, and so I had 4 years in the Merchant Navy, and I obviously learned a lot about, you know, navigation and safety and seamanship, and that transformed into my boat fishing passion through the 80s, and that is where Mel Russ and Cliff had identified me. They wanted someone to really sort of get into the boat angler side, doing the boat reviews, navigation features, safety features, maintenance features, where to launch features, etc., etc., etc. And that became for many years my strong point. And
what boat did you have?
My first boat was a Barry Bass boat.
Yeah.
They were built locally in Barry. Very basic sort of displacement boat.
Solid boat though.
Yes, yeah, it's steady. I think 16 foot, 7.5 mercury on the back. That's a, you know, fantastic fishing. And then that worked into an Orkney strike line. My first Orkney strike, and a second Orkney strike liner, and sort of went from there really. But it was always the boats that was the key thing. But the beauty of working with a Sea Angler, and you know, once you know it sort of settled in and knew how the magazine worked, I could ring Mel and say, "Look, I've heard that, you know, here the fishing's really good in Whitby just now. Are you interested? Yeah, get yourself up there." And that would be that. You know, my petrol would be covered, my digs would be covered if I needed them. If I was going to Whitby, I need an overnight. And, the support package was there. It wasn't a case of, well, you know, I'm going to earn £100 for an article, but it's going to cost me 70. You know, it was there. And they were true to their word from day one, and that's how it worked. And he would often come to me and say, right, you know, in those days, you know, there were 4 or 5, 6 pages, more than that, at the back of the magazine, charter boat adverts.
Yeah.
Well, that's where the charter boats used to advertise. And he'd say, you know, right, so-and-so in Plymouth wants you to come down and, you know, wants a feature in the magazine, can you do it? Yes, you know. Or the advertising, you know, we're doing a profile on Weymouth. You know, can you contact a few skippers in Weymouth? You know, and that's how it used to work. So I used to do a lot of shore fishing content, but the majority of my work was always boat orientated.
Do you prefer the boat side of the fishing over the shore, or are you just happy?
In the UK, I think I've gone from being, I suppose you could say, I was a hardcore small boat angler. If I want a bit of pleasure fishing now, I'm more likely to go shore fishing. I love surf fishing. I love bass fishing. I do a little bit of lure fishing. I've done a lot of lure fishing for bass over the years, but I'm not like Danny, and I know you had Henry in recently, who's like Mr. Lure Fishing for Gilby. Henry, he's Mr. Lure Fishing for
Mick, bass. Yeah, we have Mick Ward on yesterday.
You know, I mean, you know, what they don't know about lure fishing for bass isn't worth knowing.
But or for a bait angler.
With me, I love the surf fishing. That's number one for me. You know,
I think my first, so it would have been my dad had bought the magazine, but my first time I can remember seeing an article from you was surf fishing, and I want to say it was possibly bait fishing for golden greys.
Oh, that's well on down the line. That's the back end of the 90s.
Yeah, I mean that's my first. I remember seeing.
Yeah.
Knowing, and obviously not at the time.
Programming Matt Hayes as well.
Not at the time knowing it was you, but then later on, when I grew older, knowing who you were, then I remember seeing Golden Grave articles you in the surf. So
that was Langenneth Beach, which is, you know, if I could only fish one place in the UK, you know, it would be there. I just love it there. You know, bass, flounder, golden grey mullet. I just love the beach. I just love the day out. But also, I enjoy the rock fishing, you know, peeler crab, you know, ledger, you know, free line, close range in the gullies. I prefer that to the modern lure fishing scene. But, you know, I'm fortunate. I live in an area where we've got a bit of everything. We've got some of the best surf beaches in the country. We've got excellent rock fishing marks and
sport for choice.
Everything else in between, yeah, pretty much.
And boat fishing thrown into the mix.
And boat fishing. I mean, at the time, early 90s, they were really the start of the best years of cod fishing inshore in the UK. And Penarth, Cardiff Bay, Barry, Swansea Bay, you know, they, in the winter, I'd say we had the best inshore cod fishing in the country. I mean, the Thames Estuary was very good. The Solent was very good back then. But inshore fishing with bait uptide in the Bristol Channel in the summer months, you know, is the northeast back then. It was, you know, Whitby, Bridlington, Scarborough. I mean, you know, all lure fishing up there. You know, the northeast cod used to eat metal. They didn't know what a lugworm was up there. It was just metal.
So were you travelling straight off the bat for your fishing?
No. I joined Sea Angler in the March, and within a week or so, Mel on the phone again, he said, what are you doing, whatever, towards the end of April, like a month away? I said, can you get a few days off? I said, yeah, I think so, you probably can, you know, it's you know, normally not difficult getting time at that time of year in the fire service. He said, would you like to go to Denmark? I said, yeah. He said, right. He said, John Wilson's going over there doing a researching a program. We've had an offer to send a journalist. Everyone's calling me a journalist now, which took a minute again. You see, there's a chance. They've asked us if we want to send someone over and, you know, do an article for the magazine. You know, would you like to go? And obviously I said yes. It's the best thing. I forget how, but I ended up on the phone with the manager or the owner of the Seven Islands Resort where we were going to be based in Ebeltoft. And we were chatting away. His English was very, very good, as a lot of, you know, continental people are. And he said, "Oh, you married? Yeah, you got two kids." He said, "What's happening?" And he said, "Would you like to bring your wife and children with you?" I said, "Pardon? Would you like to bring your wife and children with you?" And I've been with Sea Angler now for a matter of weeks. And I said, "I'd love to." I said, "How much would it cost?" "Oh, you know, we'll cover the cost. You know, we've got a budget for this." And so I went down, Alison, you know, we got, it turned out to be a week. And it was, you know, flights, Alison and the kids, Heathrow, the Billund, and then, you know, and then a week's there and out for meals every night. And so, you know, Alison's starting to get a bit of feedback, you know, apart from the financial situation being adjusted.
Now she's now extra perks.
Exactly. So, yeah. And went to the airport, and obviously, you know, John was the man then. It was, you know, John's program.
Legend.
You know, the other one was Nick Fisher, who we were talking to, Henry about. Became very friendly with Nick as well.
Screaming reels.
Yeah, way ahead of his time.
Loved that. On a Sunday night, we always had to go for a family walk on a Sunday, but me and the old man used to sit there and watch it. Yeah. I used to get my fishing rod out in the front room, and I'd start tying rigs and all the rest of it. Absolutely loved that.
Crazy Australian woman used to smash things.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm at Heathrow Airport. There's John Wilson and... John,
did you met him before at this
stage? This is the first time I met him, and again, we got on well, and he became a very, very good friend. We used to go and stay with him, and he used to come and stay with us within a few days of being away. The shad thing came up again. John was desperate to catch a shad, freshwater fish. He had a book coming out later that year on freshwater species. He said, "Do you think you can get me a shad?" I said, "I guarantee it. Absolutely no problem at all." And the timing was perfect, because this was April, and May is the main month for the shad. So anyway, we went to Denmark. We did the thing over there, got on well, did some fishing there. He said, "Yeah, we're going to do a program. We're going to do it in September. Would you like to come and join us?" Yes, I've landed on my feet here. So I went, and... you know, a couple of things happened on that trip which were all fantastic. I mean, the very start of it, John's interview in a local fly tyre, because big part of the programme was going to be sea trout. They got a big sea trout in the sea thing there, and some, you know, some of the rivers. And we were going to start the programme using an interview with this local expert. And he said, "Dave, you know, you might as well go and fish the river down there. Just, you know, you won't be a part of this." "Fine, suits me." And I went down, and within about 10 minutes, I took the good fish, and I caught this 8-pound, 10-pound, where it was, barrel of silver. I thought, John, I got a sea trout on. Would you like the... No, it's okay, Dave. You know, we've got the week. We'll get it. It's just okay." So landed the fish, kept it, took it up. And you see the look on the face of the local. It wasn't a sea trout. It was a salmon. And this river, on average, for the last 20 or 30 years, produced a maximum of 12 to 20 salmon per year. And I just
chucked it first time.
I just got one. But, you know, they call me, Keith Arthur started to call me Lucky Lewis, but, you know, luck does come into these things. But the main part of the programme I was on was we were going to fish off Hanstone on a big old wooden trawler called Thailand. And it was, you know, we boarded it at about 10 o'clock at night, and it steamed right out into the North Sea to fish an area called the Yellow Reef. This is pre-Norway days now, way, way, way pre-Norway days. And the object was to get some big cod, and big cod then were like 20, 30 pounds. You know, there was a chance we might get a 40, you know, this sort of thing. We went, and I'm absolutely terrified now, because this is the first time I've had, like, you know, it was like a proper film crew. It was like two cameramen, a producer who was Paul Martingale, who was actually Henry's producer with Fishing with Henry. I watched the one with him. It was Paul. He used to work with John Wilson then, and sound man and recorder and assist. You know, it was like a full crew, and there's me, and I'm in the North Sea, but the conditions, you know, it's all good. I'm just terrified. I'm not going to catch anything. I'm just terrified that I'm going to do something stupid or say something stupid, or, you know, I'm going to upset them in some way. Cut a long story short, I broke the Danish ling record on that program. I had a 48.5-pound ling.
Fucking hell, Dave.
And Yeah, and I had a cod of 20, 30 pound cod as well.
How are you fishing for them?
Perks. It was all perks. Perks. And, you know, the original stainless steel Norway Solvroken perks, yeah. 17 ounce, I mean, deadly. They still are in Norway now, but, you know, they're hard work to fish properly, and especially in deep water. But, yeah,
Had you done any of that fishing before?
Yeah, plenty. I'd done a lot of it off the northeast coast, Whitby. I used to fish in Whitby quite a lot. Scarborough, Scotland. I'd done
it. You were comfortable going out there. You weren't like...
I used to do a bit of perking in the English Channel as well then. I mean, the wrecks. I mean, they used to use, like, the standard thing was killer gear. It was a perk with a couple of Eddystone eels or the very basic rubber eels above it. So, yeah, I was happy with the fishing. I just didn't want to make a prat of myself on camera. And John was just over the moon with us. I mean, from day one, they'd wanted to break a record on go fishing. And
they did it.
I got it, yeah. And it all just continued from then, you know, doors kept opening and, you know, the opportunities to travel started coming and, I was just in the right place at the right time. The opportunity was there and we...
But you could back it up at the same time.
Alison and I, we grabbed that opportunity.
And worked hard for it, you know,
It was hard work, and but it is hard work. I mean, I was balancing a fire service with it and...
The fire service understanding, did they know what was going on?
Yes and no. I mean, at the time, you weren't supposed to have a second occupation, but, you know, unless you were stupid, I mean, you know, I couldn't do anything daft like go sick and then go fishing. I never, ever, ever did that, you know. That would have just been, you know, pensioned down the pan.
Yeah.
But by managing the shifts, which I could, I mean, there's always people who wanted Saturday nights off. You know, Dave, can you work? Yeah. Can you work for me next week? I want to go to, you know, I'm going to Denmark. I need to go on. No problem. You'd swap shifts like that. Or people want to play sport on the weekend, you know. And
so we'd
manage your shifts.
You'd suck up the weekends and go to fire services. Yeah, get some when time necessary. Off through the week.
But with the four-on-four-off shift system, it was.
Like you said, you take a few days off.
You've got 12 days. You know, it's great. You've got a week with a bit of latitude either side as well.
Were the magazines, when they started coming up with some of these trips, was it just, this is the date, you've got to go on these dates? Or would they say, have you got time to come on this and give you a bit of leeway with it as well?
Both. Quite often, then and now, the magazines were heavily... based on advertising, that's where they make their money. The cover price covers the printing costs barely.
And I think there's a lot of people even today that don't realise how much the advertising of brands and is completely correlated to an actual magazine. And a lot of people don't get it at all, do they? They see these adverts and a bit of product placement, and they just think that's what it is. But the magazine doesn't exist.
It's not a club monthly journal. It's a profit making publication. But with the 4-on-4, but going back, quite often now and again they say, Dave, you know, can you do from 1st of July to the 6th of July? You know, can you do it? No. Can't do it. You know, sometimes I have to say no. But the other way around would be, we've got an offer from the Irish Tourist Board. They want journalists to come over and, you know, visit XYZ ports, in the autumn. Can you do it? Yes. So then I liaised directly with the Irish Tourist Board, who at the time were incredible with fishing.
Michael Hennessy was my connection.
Going back before then, it was Kevin Linnane, Norman Dunlop, Peter Green. I'm going back. And, you know, they say, well, when can you come over? I said, I can make this week. Yeah, we'll make that work. And so you used to have to manage your time. And sometimes I had to say no. And sometimes I can't do that. I really want to do it. But other times I could.
Did you ever get that itch to go sack the fire service off and try and make it full-time doing that? Or did you always have that, I need the safety of the fire service behind me?
Both.
Okay.
I mean, you know, in the early days in particular, the thought was always there, you know.
Full-timer.
But it's such a good job, and I enjoyed the job. And if I hadn't enjoyed the job, I probably would have given a lot more consideration to actually doing that. But I love the job. And, you know, I retired at 51. I'd been in the fire, I joined the fire service in 81. And now we're talking, you know, mid 90s. So I've been in 50 years, and, you know, and 15 years. And, you know, I was enjoying it. And, you know, another 15 years, and I knew I'd get a decent pension. And, yeah. You know, that's the road I followed, and that was the correct road to follow.
Did at that time, were you eyeing up that, you, knowing that that pension's coming, were you thinking, right, when I get that, that's going to free me up to go full-time to some of this further destination?
That's exactly
stuff.
What it did. That's
a long-term plan.
Yeah, but I started doing the long-haul destination stuff towards the end of the 90s.
Where was your first place you went?
Long-haul, Kenya.
What made you go for that jump from long-haul? From doing the, if you felt you'd done everything in the UK, I want to.
No, nothing like that. I mean, you know, from day one, I always wanted to go to Kenya, Mauritius, Florida, and, you know, who wouldn't? I was a fisherman. I mean, that's you know, these are fantasy islands. This is where you want to fish. I see my first overseas trip with Sea Angler was the Denmark one. Then we did a couple of trips to Ireland. I did Sweden very early on, a couple of other places, Portugal. Yeah, that's pretty much it. And then Kenya, I had an itch to scratch. I wanted to go to Kenya.
Targeting what?
Marlin tuna, sailfish, inspired by John Wilson's programs, And at this time, I was very friendly with Clive Gammon. I don't know if you're aware of Clive. I'm sure you are. I mean, he is, you know, the greatest angling writer this country's ever produced. And he'd left the country. He used to work for Creole Angling Magazine. And then about 1973, 74, he moved to the States full-time and worked on Sports Illustrated, which was the biggest sports fishing publication in the world. But Clive was a good friend, and he had a contact. And again, he said, yeah, if the magazine will publish a story, Dave, you know, we can make, you know, we can source something out for you. And I rang Mel. I said, Mel, you know, would you be interested in something on Kenya? And he said, well, what are you going to do? And I sort of, you know, laid out the plan to him. I said, you know, obviously this one I'm happy to pay my own flight. And, you know, okay. And I did. I went. Alison came with me as well. I mean, she paid for her things, and that was my first sort of long haul trip. And
how did that trip go?
Really good.
Lucky Lewis strikes again, was it? Or?
No, it's lucky Lewis actually made a bit of a prat of himself on that trip, because day one, you know, I got on the boat, and Adrian Paul said, you know, this is how we fish here. Would you like to hook your own fish, or, you know, are you happy for the crew to hook? No. I want to hook my own fish. And, you know, right, okay, that's the correct way to do it. And still is the correct way to do it. But the trouble is, I didn't have a clue how to do it. And I thought, you know, catch cod, I can catch bass, I can catch this, I can catch that. So we went out, and the first couple of fish, when you're fishing in blue water, as I'm sure you were, you're either using lures or you're using baits. Well, using lures, the fish hits a lure, it's either hooked or it's not hooked. Okay, tuna, Dorado, Wahoo, occasionally billfish. At the bigger end of the scale, the marlin, but that's a different... This is sort of the smaller, the mid-range side of lure fishing. But the primary target there was sailfish, and they occasionally hit a lure, but they more often than not throw that lure, you know, when they start doing all their jumping and tail walking. The way they fish for sailfish in Kenya and most other places around the world is with bait, and they use what they call Panama strips, which is the belly strip cut from a small tuna or a Dorado.
The white.
Yeah, the white, tough belly meat, and it's got a nice soft action, and it's fished inside a squid. And, you know, we were trawling away, then all of a sudden the crew would start getting, suli, or left rigger, long rigger, right rigger, and here's me, I just stood there waiting for a rod to bend over. And what's happened is, you know, we've raised the sailfish with the teasers, and there's eight or nine different baits out there, and they're telling me which one it is, you know, left rigger, right rigger, tagline, flatline, shot, you know, whatever. I don't know, they were talking French, you know, they're actually talking Swahili, but I didn't have a clue what I was doing. I mean, you're looking for this little tiny sort of bit of a beak coming up behind. You first of all, you've got to know which rod, you know, there. You got to grab that one, pick it up. But there's a whole procedure. I didn't have a clue. What I should have done was, right, yeah, okay, it's on that rod. Pick that rod up, thumb on the spool, reel into free spool. You feel the fish, tap, 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 tap. And that's only the bill hitting the bait because the boat's still trawling.
Yeah.
And then you just free spool it back a little bit, keeping your thumb on the spool just to keep the you know, so the fish doesn't feel too much pressure and it doesn't overrun because you look, all right.
Yeah, be a little line off
when that happens. when the fish, you see the fish, then when it takes the bait and turns, reel the strike position, line tights, ding, 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 fish on. Well, I did have a clue. That first trip to Kenya, not one sailfish. It was only by the end of the week that I'd started finally
tweak what was going on, yeah.
But I managed to get back 6 months later because I started the company that Clive had put me in touch with. They put me in touch with a lovely lady called Annie Ayton, who at the time ran a company called Safari Plus, who were based in Dorking in Surrey. And she did a lot of African destinations. And we hit it off and we came back from that trip to Kenya. We got an article published. And she's, you know, but 6 months, 8 months later, she said, would you like to go, you know, we've got these other companies, places we'd like to look at. The one was in the Pemba Channel, which was further south in Kenya. And, you know, possibly, would you like to, you know, a couple of days on safari as well? Yeah. So, and then that trip went well. I got my sailfish. And then Annie, I can't remember who was Annie or myself, but we came up with the idea of hosting trips, guiding. Some of the trips, I actively do a little bit of guiding, but most of it is just hosting the trip and what have you. But so we thought, well, yeah, let's you know, see what we can do. So, well, you know, the deal is, you know, you know, the airline will cover your, if we're taking a group, you know, so many people, the airline will give you a ticket. And you know the lodges. If you're taking so many anglers, they'll cover your costs. So basically, if I could, you know, if we could pull together a group of 8, 10, 12, whatever it was, anglers, my trip would be free. And you know, I like the sound of this. And she put an advert in Sea Angler, and
was it received well?
Yeah. And
was it taken up more than you thought it was going to be?
Instantly. And we did, in total, somewhere in the region of 25 trips to Kenya over 20 years with Annie. But then all the other African destinations were starting to come online. And the next big one was Namibia. Going back to Clive Gammon. Now, I was in his house in Swansea one day, and he said, Dave, come out, look at this. And I look, and he's got this bit of a... This guy here, he's fishing, look at the size of these bloody sharks he's catching on the beach down in Namibia, and all these big cob, and he's like bass fishing on steroids. And
they're bronze whalers, isn't it?
Bronze whalers, yeah, mostly bronze whalers then. And I'd actually seen, Mustard had produced a promotional video, and a little bit of footage on that was on the Skeleton Coast. So Clive got a commission to do something for the Field magazine. Mel said he'd be interested in something on Namibia. We flew down to Namibia. The first day on the beach, it was like a break-in session for us, but we were catching these, which I now know are baby cob, you know, 2.5, 3, the biggest were 5, 6 pounds, and steam brass, again, similar sort of size. And, you know, it was like one a chuck, you know, it was easy fishing just to ease us into it. And these gully sharks, which are basically bull huss.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Big old bull huss.
Big dog fish,
but, you know, 20, 30 pound. And I was happy doing that. And he said, oh, tomorrow we're going, you know, we go fishing for the bronze. This is Johan Berger, who subsequently went on to be, you know, he is the best guy down there then and now. The following day, he said, all right, we've got to catch some bait first. And the bait then and now was bull huss, smooth hounds, and different types of ray. I mean, a 20, 25-pound smooth hound was the perfect size for bait.
Fucking hell. You know,
it's true. And so you catch those, and then they drive another 50 miles up the beach. There's, you know, it's just like, wow, look at all the, look.
Are they ballooned out, or are you, how are you getting those out?
Casting. So we've caught the bait, and...
Oh, they clip on, oh, what did they call it? Those, like, one-way clips?
No, nothing like that. They do in some places, but not here. This is a surf beach. It's a flat beach. So we caught the bait, which is like, you know, a couple of gully sharks and a smoother and whatever, and then the back of the pickup and up the beach. I mean, we find a spot because, you know, Johan was the ultimate perfectionist. I mean, we drive 20, 30 miles up the beach to a spot, and he'd look at it and he'd just sit there looking, and, you know, he wouldn't say a word for 3 or 4 or 5 minutes. Nah, come on, carry on. What was wrong? Oh, the water's the wrong temperature. Right, okay, yeah. The colour's wrong, it's too green. Okay. He got to the next spot and he stopped the same thing again. No, the current's not quite going the right direction. Oh, what do you mean? The current's going north-south and we need it to come south, you know, the other way to work the banks properly. Anyway, you finally find a spot, get one of these gully sharks out, remove the gills, remove the liver. That's the actual hook bait. And then the carcass of the fish would be staked in the surf and that was your chum.
Yeah.
Okay?
Okay, yeah.
So... the baits now are this size. The rods are 14-foot South African surf fishing rods that make the stiffest ziplecs look like a fly rod. Okay, I mean, these are serious, serious pokey tools. The reels are CT-converted Pen 6Os loaded with 40-pound monofilament straight through to a wire trace. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. Reel down the butt. You know, a 6-0 reel, you know, you'd use for poor beagle sharks or conger or skating in the UK. That's your surf casting reel. And to watch Johan cast this was a thing of absolute awe. You know, you would just put these baits out distances, I mean, well over 100 yards. Okay, I want to say to a...
punishing.
What size ledge are you using?
6 ounces, 8 ounces, you know, I mean, but, you know, it was just, I'd never seen anything like it. I mean, I thought I knew a little bit about distance casting, I thought I knew a little bit about, you know, pendulum casting and the whole thing.
I was going to say, this isn't just a...
just overhead, off the go, whack!
Really?
And this thing would just fly out there. Anyway, you know, I was having a go. I could cast maybe 30, 40 yards. I was scared to let it go because I knew I was going to get an overrun. You know, I mean, this, a Pen 6-0 is not designed for surf fishing.
Is that sort of gear at that stage just mixing match stuff, basically? They were still learning what they wanted?
No, they knew exactly what they were doing. Right, okay. They were so far ahead of, you know, that's how they fish in South Africa. Still do. I mean, there's a lot in recent years on social media. People are going down and fishing in South Africa and not Namibia, catching the big ragged tooth sharks and even getting makos and whites from the beach in South Africa. But Namibia was always, you know, the big sharks were bronze whalers, bronzies, copper sharks, they call them as well. Occasionally you get a cow shark, which is like a even bigger bullus with horrible teeth. And, you know, but anyway, after about 40 minutes, Clive hooked up a fish. And this was, you know, this is what was going on and on and on. And, you know, after about an hour, Clive's still fighting this fish.
Is this digging to the sand jobs?
Yes.
And just...
Yeah, he was at this stage. He was actually more or less in the passenger seat in Johan's pickup truck. And I was, you know, sort of going around snapping away with the camera, but there's only so many pictures you can take of someone, you know, with
getting their ass
grimace on their face and a big bent rod. And by now, there's another couple of bronzies swimming around, you know, trying to get at the bait that's, you know, the chum that's staked out, you know, the carcass of the gully shark that's staked out on the surf line. So I picked up my rod, which I'd reeled in when Clive hooked up, and just lobbed the bait out, okay? 30, 40 yards, if that. Held it, held. So I hooked one, and mine was a little one. Mine was 100, 120, something like that. But I actually cast to my first bronze whaler shark myself, which is, again, ultimate. Like, most of the fishing, the guy does the casting down there. They cannot hit the distance. After about, you know, 3 or 4 trips down there, I used to have a little go. I could start getting an okay-ish distance.
Distance key with that sort of fishing? Did you have to get
You had to hit the right spot. It was exactly like surf fishing in the UK. You had to hit where the fish were. You had to get into the gullies. You had to get the other side of the sandbanks. You had to be able to read the water. And this is, I learned more from that side of fishing with Johan than anything else. I mean, again, I thought I knew about surf fishing, but the way the South Africans read the beaches. But Clive, in the meantime, Clive was well into his 60s, and he wasn't the fittest man on the planet at that time. And I was seriously worried about his health at one time. But we finally got his fishing, and it was 260 pounds. And that's, you know.
Sort of time for him to get that in.
Yeah. Oh, he was two and a bit. You know, he did well.
For all him, yeah.
So, backtrack to Annie now at Safari Plus. This trip was a success. Mel ran two features in Sea Angler to back it up. She ran an advert. I could have filled 3 or 4 hosted trips of 12 anglers per trip easily every year. But for once a year for the next 8 or 10 years, I did a hosted trip to Namibia. And the fishing at that time was incredible. On every day, on the first 2 or 3 trips, by the time we sat down to dinner at the end of the first day, every angler had caught a fish in excess of 150 pounds. And the numbers we were catching, they were just off the scale. I mean, Johan deliberately wouldn't take you to places where you catch a lot of fish for the first 3 or 4 days of the trip, because he knew you just weren't up to it. But then, you know, the last day of the trip was either a place called Long Beach, which was just to the south of Swakopmund where we were based, or Donkey Bay, which was around the back of Walvis Bay, Whalefish Bay, which is, you know, on the coast there, a very famous port. And the fishing there was just, wow. I mean, you could just lob a bait into this deep channel. It wasn't really surf fishing. It was like fishing in the teen, you know, but it was a deep channel that was coming out of the back of the bay. And it was thick with sharks, and, you know, everyone could more or less put a bait in themselves there and hook up. And I had 9 in one day. That was the most. We ran out of traces. You know,
arms hanging off.
Yeah, just wrecked. You know, they destroy you. I saw several times, you know, sort of big, strong blokes, you know, builders, you know, on the verge of tears, you know, because they're trying to use their strength to bully these things in.
Not the gear, yeah.
Probably very quickly learned that wasn't the way to do this. And, you know, you really had to, you know, there's a bit of technique to it. You've got to know when to pull them, when not to pull them.
You strapped into it like a fighting harness.
No, you've got a butt pad.
Yeah.
You need
just
a butt.
You're just hanging onto it, yeah.
Yeah, you just hang on, and it's crippling. And you've just got to know when to pull. But if you try and, you know, if you try and sort of bully those fish in the early stages of the fight, you're going to destroy yourself. But it's the smaller your back, it's your back that takes it. It's hard work, very hard work. But what we used to try and do, or what I used to try and do, as that, you know, I say I did 8 or 9 trips there back to back, was as I started to understand more and more about the fishery, we used to designate at least one day, or sometimes 2 days, to fish in what they call edibles, which are the cob, the steam brass, galleon, which is like a little bream species there, black spot, blacktail, which is another little bream-like fish. But when you actually go in there to fish them, Johan would take you to the best places that would fish them, and you'd have the correct baits, which at the time were pilchards or octopus or squid. You know, you'd have the bait geared up for those. And, you know, we'd be catching 30, 40, 50-pound cob, you know, that big in the surf. Incredible fishing. But, I mean, there's still good fishing in Namibia, but the Chinese moved in and...
everything.
The fins. It wouldn't be so bad if they did eat everything, but they didn't. They just wanted the fins. There's still good fish down there, but whereas we used to get big numbers days, I don't think they're as prevalent as they used to be. Johan still does trips. If anyone was interested in the Bushworks... It's his company now. He does safaris and fishing. But he fishes up at the mouth of the Queen River, which is the extreme north of Namibia, big estuary on the border with Angola. He occasionally takes trips into Angola as well, but he gets cob up there 80, 90, 100 pound plus. So that's like a 100 pound plus bass in the surf.
Do they fight well? I've seen some of the videos of them.
Yeah, they go.
Yeah. I've seen a load of guys. I've seen a few of the. It's actually slow pitch jigging for them. Mm-hmm. They've done some trips out there, and there's a load of bycatch where they're getting snapped up and bitten off, but they've gone out there and tried to target them. And
never boat fished off there.
Looks a lot of fun, you know?
Yeah. No, it's. But Johan's the guy, Johan Berger. He's still in the game. And it's. Let's have a look. Bushworks. Bushworks, one word. Try that. Bushworks, one. Put in Namibia.
Get your spelling out.
I know he's on Facebook, but he's.
Any idea how to spell it?
I got a feeling there's an X instead of a K in works, but.
It is.
But Johan Berger, and he's...
Bushworks Namibia.
He's...
Namibia.
He's very... You know, he's one of the best guys I've ever fished with. Total, absolute professional. He'd pick you up at 8 o'clock in the morning outside the hotel.
N-A-M-I... There you go.
Namibia fishing trips.
There it is.
It is. Here's an X. I can't focus on it from here. That's the man. And if you go to fishing tours, and you should come up with some pictures of huge cob.
Oh yeah, there's the rods, blimey.
Fishing tours. Oh,
looks like go to gallery. It looks like that
gallery. Yeah. You'll see fishing. It'll break your heart. He's doing like, this is a Tosha. This is one of the big game areas. His Facebook footprint is much bigger than this.
It's down the bottom, mate. Yeah, keep going down. Hit the Facebook logo. Let's jump off and see if it's...
Yeah. All this tech is incredible, isn't it? No, it's taking us to Facebook. But he's still active, and the way the pound is so strong against the South African rand at the moment, which the Namibian dollar is based directly against, it's excellent value. And he's one of the greatest guides I fish with anywhere in the world.
So after you'd come to the end of those trips, where was the next place on your list?
I was still doing Kenya trips. I mean, Namibia I used to sort of do in January, and then Kenya in February, March. You know, I used to manage a few of them. But at the same time, I did trips. Here we go, Tanzania, Mozambique a couple of times, Madagascar. Uganda. I also did some freshwater fishing, quite a bit of freshwater fishing for tiger fish in Zimbabwe, Zambia, Botswana, South Africa. I fished with Annie as well. Costa Rica. We started, doing some trips to Costa Rica in the 90s with Annie. It was really going well. It was just, this was building up now.
Were you always guiding on those trips? Or
hosting.
Hosting.
She used to do private trips as well. If a group of guys wanted to go and fish on their own, yeah, of course. But the hosted trips, it was just as much as I wanted to do, as much as I could do, really. And it just sort of just took off, and it did more and more and more. And where does this take us up to now? Certainly the change of the millennium. And around this time, I'd started picking up bits of info. By now I was working for some of the Dutch and German magazines and French magazines, and I was seeing more and more stuff from Namibia. Norway. Norway was an unknown entity. I'd never read anything.
Just the early days of like the halibut fishing and stuff like that.
This is the start of it. I didn't start the fishing, but I was the first to, like Namibia, I was the first to publicise it in the UK for British anglers.
And just to jump back, how did you end up picking up French magazines, German magazines? Did you start having their people coming out to some of these hosting
Some of them, things? I mean, one of the, Pierre Bronsgeest, he used to be, he sadly died last year, the year before. He was the editor of a big magazine in Holland called Beat, which published in the Benelux countries, Holland, Belgium, and Luxembourg. And it's like a tri-discipline magazine, course, game, and sea, and the same thing. And he got in touch with me, and I started working for him. John Wilson got me in touch with a magazine called Fisk and Fang in Germany. And, you know, doors were opening now. You know, the ball was really kind of...
You're still full-time with Sea Angler.
I'm still full-time with Sea Angler.
So, you know, full-time with Sea Angler, you're doing hosting,
mm-hmm.
and you're now taking on extra magazines again.
Yeah.
Were they doing it on, like, a paper article basis?
Yeah.
Or did they
no, that was paper article. And most of those articles were ones that I'd already done for Sea Angler, and I'd rework them and, you know, put, like, a continental slant on it, you know, pounds to kilos and miles, kilometres, this sort of thing. But I was seeing more and more stuff from Norway, and Pierre Bronskies invited me to come over to the big Dutch show at the time, which was the equivalent of the show we used to have in Birmingham in the UK, to do a couple of presentations. They were really getting their uptide in, and so I got invited over. And during that show... guy's name, I am hopeless with names, as you were going to find out more and more. What was his name? But he was involved with a camp near Trondheim in Norway, and he invited me. He said, "Would you like to come over and, you know, we can do some articles in the UK magazines?" And, you know, they were looking to get British clients there, because there weren't any British clients going there.
Who were going at that stage? Or was it
Dutch, German, Eastern Europeans, Lithuanians, Latvians, Estonians, Finns, Swedes, Danes.
Just no English.
Everyone knew about it apart from we did.
But why do you think that was? Why do you think they were all on it and we weren't?
I think it's a very, very, very easy answer. Right, we'll pause this conversation now, and we'll go off on a little bit of a tangent. Okay, Norway's always been there.
Yeah,
those fish have always been there. Right, up until the advent of modern braided lines, reels with a decent rate of retrieve, and a numerous succession of other developments in tackle, how the hell are you going to fish them in these deep fjords?
Yeah,
you just couldn't do it. You couldn't fish. I mean, there are areas now, because Norway is a coastline. It's got a bigger coastline than the United States, including Alaska, on both seaboards and the Gulf of Mexico. That's how long the coastline of Norway is. Okay, so now we've learned a lot more about it, and there are places where you can fish in shallower water. But in the early days, it was all perks. Okay, deep water, usually deep water. I mean, 150, 200 feet would be shallow. At times, you were fishing 400 or 500 feet of water. And...
I spoke to guys that said they'd gone over there and their sounder just went blank. It can't find the bottom. It's that deep.
You know, you fish. You know, from here to that wall away from some cliff faces on the boat, and you've got 300 foot of water beneath you. So until all the modern increases in tackle, improvements in tackle started in the '90s, you couldn't really fish. You're the best fishing in Norway, the southern Norwegian places, sort of south of Trondheim, Bergen, around Oslo Fjord. It's not much different to Scotland and thing, but it's bordering on the North Sea, so it's impacted massively by the EU fishing fleet. Norway, as a country, is not a full member of the EU. It's got some association. I can't remember exactly what the definition is, but they control their fishing and they do it properly. Okay, so the fish are there, the tackle's there, so all we needed now was, the camps and everything to develop. Because, you know, there were a few camps and, charter boats didn't exist. You know, people couldn't comprehend why people would want to go fishing for 8 to 10. Why do you want to fish 8 to 10 hours on a boat? I've had this conversation with people up there so many times. Like, 2-3 hours, isn't that enough? I said, no, we want to come for... Because they fish for cod for food. Halibut for food. Haddock for food. That's the only reason they go sea fishing. The sport fishing community in Norway was and is insignificant. You know,
they're there to fill a box.
They're there to fill a freeze. You know, they go fishing, catch their fish, and... Klaus John Jonkerman was the guy I met. That's a mouthful, isn't it? Klaus, C-L-A, Klaus John, and he invited me. I'm back to the show in Holland now. Would you like to come up? Yes. Spoke to Mel. Mel, you know, interested in a couple of sea fishing features from Norway. Again, totally supportive. Yeah, go do it. I went, and the fishing was good. Blew on brilliant. You know, it probably wasn't as good as the best days I'd had off Whitby. I mean, the average, I didn't see a 20-pound cod. In, you know, we fished three or four places during that first week. We had cod to double figures. I don't think we had an honest 20. And
was that because of lack of knowledge of what you were doing?
No, because we were fishing in the wrong places. We were fishing in southern Norway then. And this is where, you know, the few camps that were then in existence were based. So came home and I wasn't disappointed, but I knew there was more. Kept in touch with Klaus John, and he sort of got me another invite because it became apparent. Another company actually took me to Norway, fishing a little bit further up the coast on the Arctic Circle at a place called Lovund. But the weather was against us that trip. Caught some fish, did catch a few better sized cod on that trip. Nothing like people see now, you know, but a couple of honest 20 pounders, possibly a 30. But again, it was the boat thing. You know, you just couldn't get a boat to go fishing, and they had these little tiny tinny things, and you know, the weather was against us. So that was my second trip to Norway. Then I had a third trip to Norway, which is my second one with Klaus John, and that was further north again. And yeah, it was okay. It still wasn't fantastic. That year, I was working, or you know, doing the talks and things at the fishing show in Birmingham, and I met Martin Founds at Anglers World Holidays, and he was doing a lot of stuff I knew in Sweden, Denmark, purely on the course fishing side. And I said, you know, would you be interested in, you know, doing something in Norway? I said, I got this contact, and you know, he's keen to, you know, sort of start getting some British business over. You know, we feel it'd be of interest to British sea anglers. It's the species they like, it's the techniques they like, you know, and you know, a good sized fish. So Martin jumped on it straight away. We arranged another trip. We went to Sjervoy, which is one of the famous camps up the north. It was one of the very first camps to actually be built as a proper fish camp for visiting anglers. Yeah. At the time, their trade was nearly all continental, but it was all continental. No Brits had been there. And we went fishing, but again, you know, we were struggling. And we just weren't getting, it wasn't, I made a mistake. It wasn't Sjervoy then, it was a place called Kapangan, which is another fjord across from Sjervoy. And we were staying in this fisherman's cottage, and he was having some houses built on the side of the fjord for setting up a camp. And I was up there with a friend, Steve Humperson, and we'd been fishing a couple of days, and we were catching a few fish, but you know, again, it wasn't setting the world alight.
Did you feel there was more to be caught?
We knew there was more to be caught. Absolutely, categorically knew that something was wrong. We were doing it wrong. We didn't know what we were doing. We were totally out of our depth. I'm back in Kenya, you know. Yeah, I know how to catch a cod. Well, I didn't. You know, and Steve the same, and he was just totally new to us. So the one day, it had been particularly brutal, you know, horizontal bloody snow coming across the fjord, and we went back in, and, you know, we sat in the room, you know, drinking coffee, knocked on the door, and yawned, how are you boys doing? Ah, oh, we're struggling, you know. Oh, there's loads of fish, big fish out there. Come with me this afternoon, I'll take you out on my boat. So we went fishing that afternoon on his boat, and he took us out of the fjord, which was out of the range, really, of where the boat that we were, you know, a little aluminium, 18-foot aluminium boat with a 30-horse engine on the back. I mean, it was beyond the realms of that. But he took us way outside the fjord to a reef off an island called Arnoy. And we hit the mother load. It was, I can remember it like it was yesterday, honestly. It was cod fishing heaven. It was still one of the best days I've ever had in Norway, and I've had some incredible days. If I told you what we caught, you'd think I was lying. But that day, I mean, the average size of the fish was 20, 30 pounds. After about an hour, I wouldn't get the camera at the bag for anything that looked less than 40. You know, and you know, we had you're talking cod this big. You know, the fish, you know, 30 pounders were coming up. They were a nuisance. You were dropping down, you know, we were perking, and it was just instant. It was like catching mackerel. You know, it was another one, another one. It was just fish after fish after fish after fish. I took a photo that day. We had a journalist that had come out with us as well. He'd invited a friend of his who wrote for the local Trondheim Express or wherever it was. And I took a photo of Steve Humperson, the skipper, and the journalist at the end of the day, and they had, I think it was 8 fish in front of them. They were all 35, 40 pound. They were all, most of them were 40 pound plus, but there was nothing under 35 pound. That became a double centre spread of a 6 or possibly an 8 page feature in Sea Angler magazine. Martin Fownes' foams at Angler's World melted.
It just went mental.
That is what started off that day. That afternoon is what started what people do in Norway now. By this time, Angler's World holidays were, you know, all course fishing, but then now the Martin's gone full bore now on the sea fishing.
Well, that's pound science, isn't it?
It was just.
They knew that they had those cod out. They had those sea anglers that were like loving catching a 5 pounder over here from the shore, going over there and saving a bit of money and catching these fish.
It was clearly going to be massive from that day onwards. At the same time, Annie at Safari Plus, she was a single lady working her own business. She's starting to wind down a little bit, so Lucky Lewis now slots from the one to the other. And, you know, I was doing a little bit with the two for the time being, but then Annie sort of drifted towards retirement and I started doing more stuff with Martin. My first hosted trip to Shervoy. Shervoy was further down the line. Back to Kapangan. We had a big old wooden boat called Pendler. It used to be a hospital boat. It used to go around the fields doing minor operations.
You know, how'd you pick that boat up?
I think Martin must have found it. I can't remember it exactly. I didn't know. They took over with all that side then. I was in the case of, right, you know, we come up, this is what we're going to do.
Was it like that Jaws moment on that trip where you go, we're going to need a bigger boat?
Yeah. We did need a bigger boat, but this a Pendler was a lovely boat. I ended up doing 6 or 7 trips on it. And I took a group up, I think there were 12 in the group. And, you know, again, you know, the fishing was just what people think Norway should be. And these are people ringing home to Martin at Angler's World Holiday, you know, saying, put me down for next year's trip. Well, we don't know what date it's going to be, and we don't know how much. I'm not asking how much it is. I'm going.
Yeah.
And the ball just rolled from there, and he went from camp to camp to camp to camp to camp. And, you know, and then it's what it is now, you know. It's a big thing. It's, we were doing Iceland as well. I mean, I started doing Iceland with Annie at Safari Plus. One of my earliest trips was 96 was Iceland. I did a few hosted trips. My first ever hosted trips were Iceland, not Kenya. I forgot about that.
was that out there for the cod, or was that?
Yeah. Iceland's, there are, again, you know, the whole thing has developed. But at the time, I mean, the first couple of years I went to Iceland, the problem, there were too many fish there. I mean, fit cod between 4 and 12, 14, 15 pounds, you couldn't get through them. It was just carnage. I mean, you know, the bigger fish didn't, you know, every day you get a few in the 20, 30 pound.
You had to wade through
a lot of fish to, you know, to get the bigger ones. But it's a nice problem to have.
Yeah, very nice problem to have. Yeah.
So you were saying, it's kind of a nice segue, you were saying earlier on that it was the tackle enabled you to be able to do these pioneering trips up there.
You couldn't have fished the areas we were fishing then without braid. I mean, I was using, at the time, you know, my reel of choice then was a Shimano TLD 20 or TLD 25.
Were you with Shimano at this stage?
Yes.
I was just about to say that. So yeah. What did that correlate? How did your involvement with working with brands and Shimano, was it directly because of what you were doing?
Going off on another tangent now. Shimano at the time, Shimano was set up in the UK by a guy called John Loftus in the 1980s, and their base was Swansea.
It's handy.
Perfect. Again, Lucky Lewis.
Lewis, yeah.
It fell into place. And one day, a reader wrote into Sea Angler and said, where can I get my Shimano reel service? And I've tried, and nobody in the UK serviced them, which was, obviously he hadn't done his research. And again, this is like 1995 or 6. So there's no internet or anything, but he couldn't find anywhere to service Shimano reels. And at the time, Shimano Swansea, they had a designated reel guy, a guy called Jonathan DeLance. And Mel, Dave, can you pop down to Swansea? We want a feature on servicing reels at Shimano's facility. And again, on the back of that, they take out a full-page advert. I mean, this is how it worked. So I went down. This was 95. Yeah, 1995. And took the pictures and went to the office, had a coffee with John, and, his managers were working with him. And, would you like to try a few of our rods out? And, yes, please. because I'm in full blag mode now. Things are going well, and I'm getting accustomed to, the odd little treat coming through the post on a weekly basis in those days. And, they gave me a couple of rods and a couple of prototypes. And then I had a phone call from a guy, Barry Jeffries, who was working with him at the time. He said, we got a dealer trip in Cuba in January. Can you make it? Would you like to come? Oh, yes, please. So I went, and that was January 96. And I've been with Shimano since then. I'm the only one that's left now, because from when they were in Swansea, they relocated to Redditch. I'm the only one that's left from those days. So that's how Shimano started, and
again, one of the originals.
Yeah, and I'm with them. I mean, obviously, I'm Mr. Shimano. I've got the hat, I got the T-shirt, and
got the rods, got but the reels. Got
I
the...
use them because they, I like their gear. I've got absolute faith in their brand. I know people, and I'm not going to name names, and I'm not going to name brands, but I know people that have been associated with various brands who they don't actually like. They don't want to use, but they're doing it because, for whatever reason. Financial or prestige, I don't know. But I never had that problem. I got involved with a company who was at the time, and it still is, a premier brand, made all the products.
Got them sat here, yeah.
All the products I need and needed and still use. It fell in place. But yeah, going back to, Norway, France, really, Namibia, Iceland.
Norway, I just took you off on a tangent with Shimano, because you're talking about the reels.
Tangle. I was using a TLD-20, TLD-25, which are great. Lever drags, perfect for braid. And pretty modest rate of retrieve on them. I think they're about 5-to-1-ish. It might be slightly above, slightly below. But they had a large diameter, which equated to a fast line pickup. But even so, they were still hard work using those. But the gear was coming along, and for the first 4 or 5, maybe 6 years I was fishing Norway, it was mostly, almost exclusively perks. That was the way to do it. Then the whole sort of soft plastic revolution took off, and obviously without any doubt, these plastics, shads that were becoming popular in the English Channel at the time.
Storm,
for pollock.
Storm.
Yeah, probably a little bit before Storm. The Storm were pre-rigged, but the first ones were just like rubber shads you had to rig yourself. And,
With a big lead head on it sort of thing.
Yeah, you could fish like Gary. You could fish off a flying collar like you used to the regulars. Yeah. But they were starting to take over, again, in the 90s, in preference to, the red gills and the delta eels on the wrecks. And you take them to Norway and you clean up. I mean, but the problem was, again, you put something that size in Norway, you're going to get a cod that size, then another one that size. And it was just too many. But then a few companies, Storm, started making some of the larger ones. And then they became good. And they were the key at the early days to catching the halibut. The halibut loved it. You occasionally pick up a halibut on a perk.
You had to go bigger.
Yeah, not necessarily bigger. A lot of the halibut you used to hook on perks were actually grabbing something that had already eaten the perk. You know, something smaller grabbed it.
It was profile, wasn't it?
Yeah, they're just nailing it. But once these big shads became available, then you could use like upgraded spinning gear, again, braid again. You had the fixed spool reels had gone from being coffee grinders to works of art. I mean, reels like the Stellar and the Twin Power, superb engineering on a global scale, clutches that could handle the fish, gears that could handle, and a high rate of retrieve. So, it was all starting to roll. In total, I probably did certainly in excess of 30 trips to Norway, approaching probably closer to 40, and I don't think I've used a perk up in the last 10 trips. It's just almost exclusively fish, soft plastics, big soft plastics. The Storm Giant Wild Eye Swim Shad used to be the go-to. They stopped making it for some reason.
Two hooks.
No, one hook in that one. The one I think you're thinking of is called a Big Bob. It's one of the West End range.
No, Storm did a Wild Eye with two hooks.
Did they?
Yeah. It was free wide, because we used to use them for pike. Cut them open with a blade, take the lead out, and then glue them back up, and you could slow sink them for pike, and that was a wild eye, yeah.
But these are the giant wild eyes, anyway.
Yeah.
They weighed, what did they weigh? Sort of 16, 17, 18 ounces. They were chunks. They get down quickly, and then you just wing them and reel them up slowly. And
did you ever have anything to do with that sort of development on the soft plastic side?
And not the lure size. Quite a bit on.
Did anyone ever approach you for it, and you just didn't want to do it, or?
I've been approached by companies that are predominant. I mean, Rapala is very closely associated with Shimano. Rapala owns Storm, so at the time, for quite a few years, I used to be involved with Rapala, but I was never involved in R&D on the product side there. I used to do quite a lot with Shimano, certainly for the upside market and the boat rods, because the standard British boat rod used to be 6-foot broomstick, but then the move started towards 7.
Do you have a bit of input in with the STC range as well, the travel ranges?
Very much.
I was going to say,
very much the STC range, and that became my forte, and I like to think it still is. Because the travel rod, Shimano travel concept, as far as I'm aware, probably someone will correct me, but I think Shimano were the first to produce good quality travel rods. You could always get telescopic rods and multi-piece rods, but I'm not knocking other brands. They weren't up to it. Shimano were the first to make good quality. The XR's range was the first range, and that evolved into the Speedmaster range. And, now it's known as the STC range. And even some of the top big game, sort of popping and jigging rods now are available in STC. And even the... some of the slow jigging rods. I mean, it's all coming together now. It's all, it's just the way that they manufacture.
Did you get the early prototypes of that stuff and then got a lot of input?
Yes.
I don't like this, I like this, I want this.
Yeah, yeah, exactly that.
Were they good at listening?
Very good. Yeah, yeah, very good. I mean, at the time, it was Shimano UK. I forget the year, but eventually Shimano UK became absorbed into Shimano Europe. Then the whole sort of management structure had to be geared towards European sales, and what people use in the Med isn't what people use in the UK, and it all had to, it's a business. You had to equate this,
Where's our bigger sales base? We're going over there.
We could produce some beautiful rods, but it costs a lot of money to produce a rod. And it costs an incredible amount of money to bring out a new reel. And then when are you going to sell? That's the bottom line. There's no point in bringing out a reel that's the best casting reel ever in the history of casting if you're going to sell 50 in the UK and a dozen in Europe, because everyone in Europe uses fixed spools. Because the first Shimano reel, apart from the TLD range, to really make an impact in the UK was the Speedmaster TSM to FSC. That was a 6.1 to the one to retrieve. Centrifugal brakes used to cast like a bullet. It was the rough ground reel, and it got dropped. And then
that was a sales based decision.
Yeah, totally a sales based decision. I think that, you know, but it would have sold. It would have continued being a hot seller in the UK. But how many are you going to sell in the UK? 1,000 a year.
If you make them too bomb proof, the lads aren't wearing through them.
It's not selling enough. It's as simple as, I mean, the UK market, to put it into some sort of perspective, so that, you know, people who are not actively involved in the tackle industry realise, you know, say, oh, you know, why can't you do this or why can't you do that? There are tackle shops in the US that sell more product in a year than the entire UK dealership.
Yeah, those pro bass shops.
You know, Bass Pro shops, yeah, Cabela's. Yeah. Yeah.
They're just ridiculous.
I mean, you know,
World Sportsman,
like
Florida Keys.
Aren't they? It's...
I mean, it's... Most of the reel... I mean, that Speedmaster reel, everyone thought it was developed for the UK long-range, rough-ground shore fishing scene. It wasn't. It was designed for downrigger fishing on the lakes and in the sea... In the US, that's what the very fast retrieve was originally designed for. Because when you're fishing on a downrigger, you've got a bait going down to a release clip, 100 foot, whatever down. When the fish snaps out the thing, there's a bow of slack line, and you've got to get tight on that. That's what that was designed for. What's the most famous reel for carp fishing in the UK?
Bait runner.
Do you know what that was designed for?
I said a diver, but... All my gears at the old...
Well, it's your Bristol jeans coming out again.
I'm the worst one for this.
Bait runner.
Bait runner is...
It's legendary, isn't it? I mean, it's had more impact on you know, the freshwater specimen scene than any other reel. And the original bait runner is Shimano. Yeah, yeah. Other brands have got great reels as well, but...
Shimano is the one.
But it wasn't developed for carp fishing. Do you know what it was developed for? Bone fishing. Seriously,
why did he get picked up over here for carp?
John Loftus, mostly people like John Loftus who recognised these products and thought, well, that'll work over here. But the way they fish it for bonefish, it's fixed bull reel, spinning reel, that's what they call them in the US. I mean, multiplier, they call it, as a casting reel, and a fixed bull's a spinning reel. You'd fish free line, they call them shrimp, but they're prawns, you know, they're things about this big. And you cast them at the bonefish, the permit, you know, all those fish. And then you snap it over and engage the bait runner feature.
Yeah.
And then it's important that when a fish picks those baits up, you've got to let them take the bait, eat it properly, and run with it. We're back to the sail fishing in Kenya now. You've got to give them a chance to get it in their mouth and run a little bit with it. And that's where the bait runner feature came in. Because rather than waiting till the fish is ripping line off at Mac whatever and trying to shut the bail arm, with a bait runner feature, you just turn the handle and click. So they can run the line and not feel any resistance, and when you're ready, snap, boom, using it. So that's the history of the bait runner. I'm not sure where this conversation's going now.
Yeah, but that's what it's about, right? You know?